Hello everyone, welcome to the EdTech Podcast, the show about education innovation in and out of the classroom. This week we celebrate 1 year of the EdTech Podcast, so definitely check out our listener special episode as well, and check out the Twitter feed for all sorts of goodies, including our listener survey and the launch of our Patreon campaign. A huge thank you all for listening in over the last year, and keep your shout outs and feedback coming in. This week, we are delighted to announce that we will be an official co-chair of the London EdTech Week, commencing the 19th of June. We will be collaborating with Nesta to bring you a live podcast on the subject, Is EdTech a Thing?, looking at various perspectives on how to value EdTech. To find out more and to register, check back in next week when I'll have the link to share with you all. I've also been preparing this week for a panel I'm moderating at ASU GSV in Utah, called Play It Smart, Games and Neuroscience, Making an Impact Finally in Education and Talent. I'll be speaking there with Pymetrics, Wonder Workshop, Minecraft and Pearson. Let me know if you'll also be in Salt Lake City. Now, before we kick off this week, in other news, I'm very excited to announce that the Japan Prize will be sharing their message over the next 6 weeks with the EdTech Podcast. Here's a snippet from my conversation with Yuki Yoshida, Deputy Secretary General of the NHK Japan Prize, with more details.
Hello.
Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, and you?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, we had a really nice weekend in London. It was very sunny. Perhaps you could explain to listeners what the Japan Prize is.
Okay, my pleasure. First of all, NHK is Japan's public broadcaster. So, we usually produce almost every genre of content, like TV programs and radio programs. But also, NHK put much importance on education. And one of the international brands to represent that value we're almost expressing how determined we are about quality or equal access to education is the Japan Prize. It's an international competition for educational media. And so we launched this competition in 1965. So we welcome all of the audiovisual content, not only TV programs and videos and films, but also we welcome all the digital contents as well, such as website and games and applications. So this is pretty much about what we are.
And so in terms of who should enter, are there any particular types of digital companies, edtech companies, who should definitely enter? And are there any that you're thinking in the future may be eligible but aren't this time around?
Okay, so because we are public media broadcaster, now we're welcoming the content which has any type of audiovisual contents in their services. So like website or across, even though it's a cross media content, like teaching kids as programming or coding, the content should have some sort of audiovisual contents in that service. So maybe some sort of like a robot who are controlled by the coding, but if that robot doesn't have audio visual contents at the moment, I think I'm sorry to have to tell that I think we have to wait for a little more to come to welcome those contents.
So it's the audio visual bit that's the important aspect. Mm,
that's right. Yes.
Okay. And then is there a cost to enter?
No, there is no entry fee, so any contents are welcome. And we already opened the call for entry for this year, so you can just simply visit our website, and we have all the entry rules and entry forms. Links are there.
Okay, great. And then the deadline is the 30th of June this year, is that right?
That's right, yes. Okay. So until that light, we have about two steps to enter. One is the filling out the online entry form. And after we accept the entry form, we will send you the email to your the links to upload your contents. And so the finishing the uploading the contents, it should be done by the deadline, which is just like you said, at end of the June. So that's www.nhk.or.jp/prize.
If people enter and they're successful, what's the benefit? What's the next step if they go on to be nominated or win?
Right, okay. So after the deadline, we have a preliminary selection process during the summer. We are announcing the finalist on September the 1st. And after you are nominated, some of the category, not all of the category, but you are welcome to present your works in Tokyo. Especially for the EdTech listener, I think it's one of the good news, I hope, is that one category which is heavily focusing on digital content, which we are calling Creative Frontier category, these are five or six finalists are usually nominated as a finalist. And these finalists are invited by NHK. We are paying your travel cost. You are invited to Tokyo to present your project in front of the final jurors.
That's
And so that
amazing.
would, yeah. So you have a free ticket to Tokyo.
Fantastic. And then the award giving ceremony, that is in the autumn, is that right?
Yes, the final selection will be scheduled from October 11th to October 18th. The final date, October 18th, is the award ceremony. So this is the one day which we, announce all the winners. And we have a best of the best prize, which is called the Grand Prix Japan Prize. So these are, presented all the winners. And we have a prize money. Each of the best category, we have $2,000 for the winner. And also we have $5,000 for the Grand Prix winners. So I think it's a, I hope it's a good information for you
Yeah,
to
no,
try.
I think it's very good. I think a lot of people will be excited and interested to enter. So thank you very much for sharing, Yuki. Do you have
You.
any final message to potential entrants?
Well, we all the believing in the power of media and the power of technology to change the world for the better place. And the Japan Prize is a very unique place for those people who get together and discuss how the media can communicate to the world and the learning aspect. So we're really looking forward to your submissions, and we're really looking forward to welcoming you to Tokyo in October.
That's great. So thanks very much, Yuki.
Thank you, Sophie.
Awesome. I hope that got you very excited. If you're not eligible to enter, make sure you recommend the prize to your favourite edu resources out there. This week's episode is also brought to you by sponsors Class Central and Glisser EDU, with a few words on them later on. Now, on to this week. I'm in conversation with the truly fascinating David Bray, Chief Information Officer from the Federal Communications Commission, in what is one of my favourite podcasts yet. This episode is the first in our South by Southwest EdTech Trend series, and we talk about what is education in an exponential age, why we need to change how we train future managers and leaders, coping with coexistence of humans and AI, and why leadership is about embracing the edge, challenging expectation, and refusing the top-down model. There's also a good few personal anecdotes in there. Bray started in the world of work at age 15 onwards, and no, he wasn't manning a lemonade stand, it seems. It was far more exciting than that. I hope you enjoy, and you can check out David on Twitter, an account he fought hard to get hold of, so make good use of it, at FCC underscore CIO. So I'm very excited to be speaking with David Bray, who is the Chief Information Officer for the Federal Communications Commission. So welcome, David.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So just to kick off, usual question, if people are listening in and perhaps aren't familiar with your work, although I'm sure they can kind of infer quite a bit, perhaps you could give me an overview of what you do and how that relates to education as well.
Sure. So right now my role is Senior Executive and Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Federal Communications Commission. The Federal Communications Commission was created in 1934. It was actually, predecessor was the Federal Radio Commission, and it's all things wired and wireless in the United States. And it's really sort to broker those issues and those concerns with the public and with the private sector. And it includes television, satellites, radio broadcast. And my role as CIO is really to think about the IT that supports the mission of the FCC.
And how about relating that to what you're speaking about here at South by Southwest EDU and education and, I mean, data and sort of student privacy, but also making the most of the opportunities of technology is massive. So, yeah, great to have your thoughts on that as well.
So what the talk that I just gave was really the idea that the world is changing exponentially, and I'll put it into some sort of perspective for folks, that in 2013, there were 7.1 billion human beings on the face of the planet, and there were 7.1 billion network devices. 2 years later, just by 2015, there are now 14 billion network devices on the face of the planet, so it's doubled. Fortunately, humans are not doubling. We're only at 7.3. But that's going to continue to play out such that in less than 6 years, by 2022, actually now less than 5 years, there's going to be between 75 and 300 billion network devices on the planet. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is the amount of data on the planet is doubling every 2 years. So going back to 2013 again, there was 4 billion terabytes of data on the planet. Library of Congress in the United States is only 10 terabytes. So I'm talking about 400 million versions of the Library of Congress. That, too, is doubling at least every 2 years, such that by the time you get to 2022, so less than 5 years from now, the estimates are there's going to be 96 billion terabytes or 9.6 billion versions of the Library of Congress. Now, some of those are going to be cat photos and, you know, YouTube videos.
Well, the YouTube videos, yeah.
Exactly. But it raises questions of we're going to be drowning in data, and how are we going to make sense of it, both of all these network devices that raise questions both about in terms of privacy, civil liberties, but also how are we going to make sense in the workplace? Because no longer will keyword search work. I mean, how many of us go past the third or fourth pages of search results? We're going to have to actually have things that are context aware and say, I see you're working on this type of task. Mm-hmm. And then again, that raises questions about, well, how do you design that? How do you make sure it's trusted? How do you make sure you address biases, both in terms of the programming and the algorithm? And really what I wanted to share with the South by Southwest EDU audience is we need to change how we train future managers and leaders. Because in this period of rapid change, if we try to be top down, in other words, if we try to direct what we believe to be truth to everybody else, we're not going to be able to keep up. And I'll sort of break it down a little bit more further. So back in 2000, I signed up for what was called the Bioterrorism Preparedness Response Program at the CDC. We were only 30 people out of 15,000 people, very large organization. And we had been created because of sarin gas attacks that happened in the 1990s. And about every 6 months, we were always told we don't need to exist. Maybe we should cut your budget. You know, you're a Cold War relic. And it was literally September 11th, 2001, that I had scheduled to give a briefing to the FBI and the CIA as to what we would do technology-wise if a bioterrorism event happened. And, of course, unfortunately, 8/34, tragedy happened, the world changed. We literally piled computers into cars. And for 3 weeks, we dealt with the response to 9/11. Stood down on October 1st. October 3rd is when I gave that briefing to the CIA and the FBI. And less than 24 hours later, the first case of anthrax shows up in Florida. Now, I share that because for those of us in the IT field, there was a thing called the Agile Manifesto, which was published in March of 2001, which basically said we need to do sort of short sprints as mm-hmm. opposed to long 2 to 3 year waterfall. And I had been pushing for agile development because I figured it was the only way we could get something out there because we didn't know when something might happen. And literally, I was being told, get back in your box, do the 5 year plan, buy into the enterprise architecture. And I was like, well, we don't have a deal with the terrorists not to strike until we've got something ready. And sure, unfortunately, you know, we did have something in place, even though it was just a minimal viable product. And so we could respond to 9/11 and we could respond to the anthrax events of 2001. I made a promise to myself that if I ever got in a position of leadership, that I would never be top down. Because in a rapidly changing world, the edge often knows what is better at the edge than the top. So what I try to encourage educators to think about is really three things. First, it's been shown empirically, actually a National Academies of Science study from 2002, that a diversity of perspectives leads to better outcomes in teams.
Mm-hmm. More profit.
Yes. Well, more profit, more better outcomes, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
That if you think about it, Frank Lloyd Wright, an amazing architect, but his buildings are falling apart. He was not a good engineer. It would have been much better to pair Frank Lloyd Wright with a great engineer and maybe a great conservationist, and you would have had a much better outcome that would last the task of time as opposed to having just one view. Because when you become an expert, and we need experts, but when you become an expert, you actually get sort of ways of seeing the world. You get certain heuristics that make you blind to other perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so what this National Academies of Science studies and subsequent studies have shown is it's actually when you have a combination of experts plus what they call naive participants about the subject that you get better outcomes than experts alone.
It's really interesting because I think it's relating it back to something that I can think about with podcast interviews, you know, if you go in and have a conversation with someone and you don't know everything about their background, then you know the conversation is much more free and than if you over prepare sometimes. So
yes, and that's what you want. You want people to ask questions. Why do you believe this to be true? So you want to re-examine, because the reality is, we all of us have what's called confirmation bias. That once we have a certain choice or a certain affiliation, that colors how we see the world. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But the reality is, the world's changing so rapidly, we can't view it through just one lens. And that's what the power of diversity shows is if you have a combination of naive participants plus experts, you'll get better outcomes. However, that only happens if you set shared goals up front.
And so do you work kind of cross department with your colleagues at the Department for Education to kind of promote this point of view?
So unfortunately, I don't actually have the luxury of time. I wish I could, but the U.S. government is fairly large. What I do actually, though, is so when I arrived at the FCC, so I arrived in August of 2013, there had been 9 CIOs in 8 years. Which is always a good sign for CIO number 10.
Now they must be like, this guy's sticking around.
Well, I don't know if I'll stick around. I mean, I like to change jobs about every 3 or 4 years, so who knows?
Really,
but I did want to survive past the average tenure. You know, 9 months, you know, if I left in less than 9 months, that would be a bad sign. But to me, it shared with me that there must be something wrong here. And so I looked underneath the hood, and a couple things. They had more than 207 IT systems, average age more than 10 years old. It was consuming more than 85% of our budget just to maintain them. And that was partly because we'd had budget cuts, we'd had sequestration and other things. And then the other thing was, the average person had been at FCC for 15 and a half years. And the average contractor had been at FCC for 19 years, even longer than the government people. And so my question was, how could I do what was right for the taxpayers, which was reduce the amount of money that we were spending to maintain these systems, do it pretty much from the existing team, because we kind of had a hiring freeze. It wasn't a complete hiring freeze, but it was sort of de facto. And so I could do some small hires, but not a lot. And so the first thing I tried to do is, first I came in recognizing that I don't know everything. In fact, I came in and said, I want to hear from you what we can do better. And I actually put a big poster that was, what's our strengths, what's our weaknesses, what's our opportunities, what's our threats, and gave people 2 weeks to write whatever they thought. And after 2 weeks, we all got together and I said, I'm going to use the Socratic method and say, where do we want to go? And the interesting thing I noticed is, over those 2 weeks, people were comfortable emailing me their thoughts, but they weren't comfortable writing on the board. And I was like, that's odd. And so again, I was doing Socratic method, so I couldn't impose my views, but I said, I've noticed that people seem to be much more willing to email me thoughts as opposed to write it on the board. Why? And there was some silence. And so I called on someone who I knew was an extrovert, and I said, you know, why do you think this is the case? And the person said, well, apparently in the past, previous leadership would shout at us as to why we were wrong. So nobody wants to really volunteer their ideas for fear of being shot at in public. And I said, well, what can I do to convince you that I won't do that? But as we proceeded on this journey, I really wanted to try and think about, how do you motivate an existing workforce that is used to dealing with incremental change to make a very large leap? Because in less than 2 years, we got all those 207 systems. We got them out of being at FCC. We moved them to public cloud and moved them to commercial service provider. And that reduced the amount of money we were spending from being more than 85% to maintain those systems to being less than 50%.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question around that. So, for example, in the UK, I suppose a lot of educational technology services are hosted in the cloud, and schools review this. And a recent survey that was UK-wide, you know, shows interest in cloud-hosted services, but it's the number one issue in terms of educators' fears around privacy.
Right.
So,
how do you address that?
I think you'd probably be a good person to inform them, yeah.
Well, and I think you have to recognize that you're going to have privacy concerns no matter where the IT system is. It's how you design the system that can address privacy concerns. So, for example, we had at the FCC, we had been paying, prior to my arrival, we'd been paying for people to volunteer to provide anonymously, so it wasn't directly attributed to them, what was their broadband speed. Because we wanted to see if the broadband speed that they were getting was actually what the provider promised. And that cost money, and it required us to do installations. And he said, well, why don't we make this so that anybody can test their broadband speed, and if they want to, anonymously share it with the FCC? But, of course, it raised questions about privacy. And if you remember the events of 2013, to come out in late 2013 and say, hi, I'm with the U.S. government, would you like to download an app to your phone that will monitor your broadband speed? That might not get a lot of uptake.
It's like when U2 put an album on everyone's phone, and people weren't really very happy about that.
Right. So the way we solved that, though, is we made the code open source. So you can actually see what the code did. And we did privacy by design. So we didn't collect your IP address. We didn't know who you were in a 5-mile radius. And most people aren't going to look at the code. I mean, that takes time. But we put the code out there. And enough groups did take a look at it and said, yay, verily, they actually had done privacy by design and they gave an endorsement. And it turned out it was the fourth most downloaded app for a while on the iOS store behind Google Chrome, which was a first for any public service agency. And so I hold out hope that in this period of rapid change, if we think creatively like that, that you think about it. I mean, most of us now have in our pocket or in our hands the ability to reach anybody in a nation, if not in the world, in less than a minute. That did not exist 15 or 20 years ago. We don't have to do the business of public service. We don't have to do the business of education or even the business of the private sector in the old ways we used to when that communication and that coordination was a challenge. It's not a challenge anymore.
That's interesting in the context that you were named most social CIO by both Forbes and Huffington Post. So is that a title that you must be pleased about that, though, if that's kind of your motive in terms of transparency? And
well, I think I had to be very conscious of, I mean, when you're in public service, you're there to serve the public. And if you aren't available for people to engage and ask questions, and you have to respond back, don't just give a canned answer, actually like have an actual dialogue as much as one can on Twitter. I think it's necessary. And so when I parachuted in, literally I came in 2013, and I said, I'd like to have a Twitter account. And they're like, why? And I said, well, I think our middle name is communications. And they said, well, you can do one on a personal basis, but not an FCC account. I was like, well, I don't think people care about me personally. It's about the role. And then they said, well, you can do one, but it just can't have the FCC name in it. And I was like, have you Googled FCC? I mean, foreign correspondence in China. I mean, FCC is a non-unique acronym. And so I went and did it. And that actually gets to, and my public affairs people did not talk to me for about 6 months, but
do they have their own Twitter account?
They do one for FCC, and actually it's got, FCC's got upwards of 750,000 followers. Yeah. And so, and I raise that because in any position, whether you're in public service or private sector, there's going to be times when you're going to have to step outside of expectations. Mm-hmm. And I say there's a difference between management and expectations. Management is when you do whether your boss expects you to do something, what your peers expect, your reports expect. In my case, what the Congress expects of me, what the administration or what the public does. We have to do that to a degree. But if all we do is meet expectations with this world that's changing so rapidly, again, the billions of network devices, the huge amounts of data, we're going to fall behind at increasingly fast speeds. And so you want people that step outside of expectations, but then that gets to the word that leadership actually comes from the Greek word leet, which means to be sent unto death. And you might say, well, wait, what is leadership about death? Well, back in ancient Greece, the leets were the ones that carried the flag in front of the melee army, and that's all well and good until one melee army meets another one, and the first ones to die are the flag bearers, the leets. And so when you're going to be a leader, I mean, it's worth thinking about how Nelson Mandela said his most trying moment was actually when he had to turn to his own party, the African National Congress, and convince them to make peace with the white minority. He almost had a coup. Israq Rabin, when he turned to his own Israelis and said, we're going to make peace with the Palestinians, was unfortunately assassinated by a fellow Israeli. And so I think about in my role, when I'm trying to lead teams and lead change, I mean, it's only 20% technology. It's 80% about people, and it's about the public. It's about the team on the inside as well. How much can I step outside of their normal expectations to deliver results without going so far that either the ice cracks or I fall through the hole or I'm now the 10th CIO that's out? And I think that is a strategy and a skill that's not taught to students. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that as a result that I'm wondering, are we selecting for future managers, future leaders that are risk averse, mm-hmm. as opposed to those that have a strategy? I mean, the reason why I went on social media was to, one, hear from people if I was missing something or if I had blind spots. And also to get the message out about the things we were doing, because that when something went wrong, it was in the context of, look, here's the 7 things we've been doing. 6 are going right. The 7th was an experiment. It didn't exactly go right.
So do you kind of buy into this idea of the snowflake generation and students not having the resilient skills that they need?
I think I would not say the generation is a snowflake. I would say that the requirement to be even more resilient is even higher than ever, mm-hmm. because of the amount of, I mean, I celebrate the internet's made us more transparent. But now everybody and anybody can see you and take what you do out of context. In fact, that's the biggest challenge, I think, is I give the example of, so in 1904, a young Ensign Nimitz, a young Chester M. Nimitz, ran his boat aground in the Philippines. He was with the U.S. Navy. He was court-martialed, but not drummed out. Instead, he was assigned to submarines. And 35 years later, he was one of only 2 5-star admirals we ever had in the U.S. Navy with the war in the Pacific. But imagine this nowadays, a lieutenant with the U.S. Navy runs their boat aground. How long on Twitter and Facebook would have been fire Nimitz? How many news pundits and comedians would have been, how could they have possibly done this? They would have been called before Congress, and probably them and their boss would have been drummed out of the Navy. I celebrate that the internet makes us more transparent, but the side effect is it making us less tolerant of people who make mistakes early on and learn from them.
Next up, a word from Class Central, which, if you're into geeking out over online learning and MOOC reports like I am, you'll probably already know about. Unless you've been asleep, MOOCs or massive online open courses are changing the way we experience higher and further education and workplace learning. With significant online courses available, gaining insight into this fast-paced world is worth spending time on, especially for those implicated by such changes. That's where Class Central comes in. Not only does it list hundreds of courses, and importantly, including non-profit courses as well as the big Ivy League unis, but the MOOC Report blog has some excellent analysis on what's up, down, new, or just slightly left field. I came across Class Central when I was preparing for a Department for International Trade webinar and found it invaluable. Since then, I've met the founder out at South by Southwest EDU, and he was excited to share the resource with all of you. So definitely go and check it out at www.class-central.com/report and let me know what you think. Yeah, the mob mentality part of it as well. And where did you learn these leadership skills as well? So I saw here you began work in public service at age 15, so I was quite intrigued around that. And what does that mean? What were you like on a lemonade stall, or were you
I was really good at computers. Okay. And so this was early 90s, and I was always fascinated about why did natural events happen. And so back when I was five, my grandfather had gotten my father and my uncles, each of the families got a computer. And not too many people in my family took to it. I did, and so I would take it apart. I learned how to program it. But the other thing I was interested in is, could I tell the computer how to model what was happening in the real world? And so I did one that was a model of oil spills in the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia. And that got the attention of science fairs, and I went to the International Science Fair. And so when I was 15, one of the quote-unquote awards was you got to work at a physics lab that was accelerating electrons to 4 giga electron volts. And they said, would you like to build some computer simulations about what happens if the beam escapes containment and things like that? And so to me, it was great because it was $10 an hour, which at the time was a steal. And two, if you think about it, this was early 90s. The only way you could really access, I mean, it wasn't even called the World Wide Web yet. It was called, you know, it was the ARPANET, and then it was later called the Internet. The only way you could access that is through a large facility. I mean, you couldn't get it at home. And so I got to play in the very early days of the Internet and build simulations. And
that must have been amazing.
It was fun. And I think it colors my thinking is that I you know, whereas, you know, I'm friends with Finn Cerf, and he's the father of the Internet. I guess in some respects, I grew up seeing it from the very early days. You know, it was literally text-based. And now it's graphics-based, and now we've got video. Now we have apps. And for me, I think it colors my thinking that, one, the technology itself is amoral. It can do good things. It can do bad things. I mean, I celebrate that we have the ability to do web searches, that we have GPS, that we have social media. But the reality is also that same suite of technology was also used to plan the Mumbai terrorist attacks. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't have that technology, but recognize it's the human element that decides whether it's good or bad. And it's almost, you know, if we wait to start having those conversations until you're in college, it's too late. We need to start having conversations very early on about what are the choices we want to do with this technology? Mm-hmm. When do we want to turn it off? When do we want to step away? When do we recognize the value of human empathy in addition to technology savviness?
So for people listening in, because I think that that's definitely true, and people are starting to work out, okay, I don't like this sort of dopamine hit I'm getting every time I see a notification, but I am addicted to it. So do you have any personal practices yourself about how much you engage with technology?
So during the week, I'm pretty much very much accessible on social media. In fact, when I go into work, I take the train in, so I'm available, and that's usually when I do my social media, and then I work, and then coming back, I take the train back, and that's when I do social media. But one thing I try to do is at least every weekend unplug for at least 24 hours, in which no email, no social media, I'm just off. And I think that's necessary. Because the reality is our brains were not evolved for this environment we're now in. In fact, it's creating a lot of, I think, the interesting, both good and negative pathologies we're seeing is we humans are not adapted for a world in which we're on 24/7 and we're connected to potentially millions of people.
Interesting. And so within the world of edtech, so many, I guess there's this freemium model as well. And, you know, many of the products out there are free in inverted commas. So obviously there are sort of data concerns around some of those applications. Do you have a view on those kind of models, or does it just go again back to the design of the product?
I think it goes back to design and the choices. So I recognize that in the private sector, there may be things that you need to keep as your secret sauce, and so you can't necessarily make it completely open source. But I am a big fan of open source. And so wherever possible, look for things where the code is available and you can understand what it's doing. I think for education, it's just that these things are, I mean, if you look at what artificial intelligence is able to do now versus just even 6 months ago, let alone 12 months ago, how do you equip students to be both aware of the capabilities of the technology, but even more important, to be critical thinkers about the values that are associated with it? I mean, here in the United States, there's actually a case where California is using machine learning to help set bail decisions. And the interesting thing with that is, machine learning and AI is only as good as the data that you feed to it. Mm. And so they fed data to it, and they actually discovered some unconscious biases in past decisions. So technology has the capability to hold up to us almost a mirror and says, are you aware of these unconscious biases you had present, you know, that you were, without awareness, factoring in someone's height in setting a bail decision, which you shouldn't. And so it could actually make us better.
That's
so I think that has a possibility. Now, it also has a downside. If you don't reveal what the algorithm is, or you aren't open about what type of data you're ingesting to teach the machine, because the reality is neural nets, it's not explicit where you say A leads to B leads to C. You just expose it enough data, and eventually it identifies that looks like a cat or that looks like a dog. If you feed in data that is biased to begin with, whether it's from the source or the fact that it's just human and that human data is biased, you're going to have a biased machine.
And so, and what does the internet in the future, or what does technology in the future look like to you? Because you were there when it was developed in the beginning. You've experienced this. You're in the right department to kind of know about these things. So, I mean, for say in the next 10 years, I mean, I'm intrigued.
Well, recognizing it's near impossible to predict the future. In fact, I think Scott Adams has a quote in which he says, there's two ways to predict the future. One is Ouija boards and horoscopes, and the other way is feeding large amounts of data into a machine. In either case, a complete waste of time. But I would say if I was to look at the trends, it is going to be increasing ubiquity of internet availability, and that could have some downsides as well as upsides. That you know, we right now think about our phone, but it may very well be in the future. It's something we're wearing. It's something that's even in the planet. It's in our cars. It's in our house. And again, in less than 6 years, there's going to be upwards of 10 to 20 times as many network devices on the planet as there are humans. Now, obviously not equitably distributed, and that's a challenge. But that's going to raise questions about, you know, one, where do you go to get off? Where turn off from this? You know, can you disappear from the grid? Are those people that are going to be able to get off the grid are only going to be the people that can afford to get off the grid? So I think that's the first question. The other thing is it's going to be much more coming at us through multiple senses. Right now, we're still pretty much reading. You're now beginning to see the early trend of where you can speak, and that there's been huge advances in voice. But I think it's also going to be through haptic senses. I mean, I could see a trend where you have a tattoo or you have something on your hand that when you meet with somebody can send signals to you through your hand without you looking down at your phone or something like that.
A secret handshake.
Yeah. Or it whispers in your ear and says, this is John. John has three kids. The last time you met him was 8 months
amazing.
Ago.
That's amazing. I'll be so useful at events like this when you're like, last night, yeah, but you know, yeah.
And so, I mean, tools always extend what humans can do. Mm. You think about it, you know, hammers, machines, they're extensions of what we can do. What makes the internet interesting is it's both an extension of what we can do physically as well as cognitively. And again, it's one of the things that you have to recognize that we humans, we have both things we do great, but we also have things that were flawed. I mean, the human condition is that of, in some respects, the traits that were selected for when we were evolving were great for either individuals or small groups, but maybe maladapted for large, massive amounts of people. And so the question is, I don't want to change the human genome. That just, I don't know, that may happen. That just sounds very problematic to me. how do we use technology to overcome human weaknesses and amplify human strengths? And I think what you're going to see, at least in the next 10 years, is it's not that AI is going to replace humans. It's going to be pairing AI with humans and teams. And it may even be the future of work is not one person getting paid for a job, but a team plus an AI mm-hmm. working together. And it's almost assignment-based.
That's interesting, because in relation to AI, it always goes back to sort of universal basic income. But right. I haven't heard that model before.
No, and I think so now you get to an interesting question of we've got really three very thorny issues that are facing us as society. So I'm going to put on a different hat right now, which is I'm actually an Eisenhower Fellow to Australia and Taiwan, which meant I traveled to those countries for 5 weeks, got to meet with their world leaders, both on the government side as well as the private sector side, and basically say, how are you getting ready for this exponential change? And the perspectives I heard in both Taiwan and Australia was, one, so globalization, which is clearly happening, doesn't rise all boats at the same time.
No.
And in fact, the sad thing is, or the challenging thing is, if you're in a country with a strong currency, your manufacturing workers cannot compete in countries with less strong currencies, which you don't really want to devalue your currency, but I think that's leading to some of the frustration we're seeing in Europe and in other places as well. The challenge is it's about the time when globalization begins to rise all boats and currencies around the world start to get stronger together, we're going to have this wave of automation that we're already seeing where you may not need as many people to do the job that used to be done by 1,000 people. And so this begs the question about, you know, if we could get every country around the world to agree to work less hours, that's a viable solution. In fact, we've had this happen before where it used to be when we were farming, you were 24/7. Then when we went to the industrial age, you didn't need to work 24/7, but you needed to work 12-hour jobs for about 6 days a week, which was not great, but it was better than 24/7. And then post-World War II, then came the, in some respects, the 9-to-5, although it wasn't really 9-to-5 jobs. And it's interesting how we dealt with that, is sitcoms and alcohol and other things. That was our way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
And so now
and
we've
Dolly
got
Parton,
this.
Dolly Parton, of course.
Yes. And so we now have this, in theory, we can all work less hours if we all agree to work less hours.
Yeah.
But if any country defects and works more hours, their economy is going to be great and everyone's worse off. And the other thing is there's also it's been shown in the American Medical Journal as well as journals overseas, there's what's called the unemployment effect. That for whatever reason, again, in our evolutionary background, those humans that needed to have a sense of purpose mm-hmm. were the ones most likely to spread their genes. And so we become despondent, we become depressed, our health goes down, our family health goes down, our community health goes down if we don't have a purpose. And in fact, that's why they say even when you retire, find a avocation to still have a sense of purpose.
Yep.
And so the question is, what is the social contract if globalization plus automation means you don't need as many people to work? The universal income, again, I'm nonpartisan at the FCC, so I'm not going to weigh into the world of politics, but I would say you need to keep in mind that may only work if you have non-scarce resources. And here's what I mean, is that if you still have scarce resources and you try to do universal basic income, guess what the price of those scarce resources is going to be? You know, basically it's going to be more than universal income. But at the same time, I'm seeing certain places around the world try what's called universal basic food. And so the idea that food in certain countries, and hopefully increasingly around the world, is no longer a scarce resource. And so that while you may not be able to do unlimited energy or unlimited raw materials or things like that, you could at least say food at this point is getting so that we can pretty much produce it, so that everyone can have access to it. And so at least we can address that. But it does raise questions about what is the future of work. You're not going to tell a company not to automate.
No, and yeah, no, it's so interesting. But yeah, that so the collaborative group model being one alternative there as well. What was your own education like?
So I went to public schools. Actually, my mom and my sister are both, or my mom's now retired, but they're both public school teachers. And my father was a Methodist minister. And so you probably hear a little bit of both the school teacher influence and then a Methodist influence. I'm a big believer in, well, my father's skill sets were healing fragmented congregations and capital planning. And I realized that any organization I go to, I apparently am playing out that same meme of something's broken, we've got to bring different teams together, how do we get them to work, and then how do we work forward towards a goal? Both my sister and I, we moved around about every 4 or 5 years. So when people say, what's home? I'm like, it's wherever you are with the family. But he went to different churches. And so then I studied computer science and biology as an undergrad. Did public health informatics, and then briefly did a PhD focusing on how to improve organizational response to disruptive events in a business school. Mm. and which was kind of interesting, and then volunteered to go to Afghanistan right after that. So it was a fun, it was about I want to say about 8 months after I finished my PhD, and I had briefly done postdocs at MIT and Harvard, and then here I am on a Spanish-speaking C-130 flying over Afghanistan that has lost my luggage, because we had checked in our bags, and apparently the pallet that had the green bags, all the green bags looked the same, and even though I'd put like a special sticker on mine, it had flown on a different plane. So I'm like, what in my life has me on a plane with no luggage flying into Afghanistan?
And you mentioned the sticker, and they're like, yeah, not top priority right now. Yeah.
I was all good. Well, I think it would happen. They actually found the bag about 12 weeks later, and apparently probably some serviceman, it was late. I mean, you fly out always late at night, like at, you know, our dark 30. Some serviceman grabbed it thinking it was theirs, and it went somewhere else. So
nightmare. So one question I always ask everyone is whether there was a book or a person that had an impact on you and your way of thinking that you continue to go back to and would like to share with everyone who's listening.
Sure. So in terms of person, if it's possible, I'll share three briefly.
Yeah.
The first one was a Dr. Robert Ballard, who actually helped find the Titanic. One of the very rare privileges I had was I got selected, again through science fairs, by the U.S. Navy to work with him on what was called the JASON Project. And so we were in the middle of the Sierra Cortez, off the coast of Mexico and California. And we would do scientific investigations for about 10 days. And we would broadcast students around the United States. And so just to meet him as a person, to see that scientists wanted to have fun, I mean, it was a lot of fun. I mean, again, it showed me that you can do the work of science, do the work of public service, and at the same time,
be a person.
Yes, yeah. Be real. And so that was very impactful for me. And then later on with the Bioterrorism Preparedness Response Program, Dr. Tracy Treadwell, so she was a epidemiologist as well as veterinarian, and her perspective on herd behavior and how you need to approach things from a systems level, not just an individual level, was very useful and very impactful in terms of my thinking about how do we think about what the individual needs and wants, but also the good of the community, the good of the society, and that we humans are inherently social creatures. And so, and she and I not only responded to 9/11, but they later responded to severe respiratory syndrome, monkeypox, and some other interesting outbreaks. And maintaining calm under fire is a good skill to have.
Yeah, do you have any tips on that?
Be a non-anxious present. I would say the world needs more non-anxious presence people who are willing to take a deep breath and say, look, it's okay. I mean, we humans have always had interesting, challenging times. I mean, England in 1940, it looked probably pretty dark, but yet it was keep calm and carry on. Although, interesting enough, I don't know if you know the story of those signs.
Are they from the Ministry of Information?
They were, and they actually were never actually used.
And it came out of the University of London.
Yes.
Yes, because my husband works there.
Yes, so the keep calm and carry on signs were only meant to be deployed in the event that the Germans had actually landed in England. That was a pretty keep calm and carry on.
That's such a British response.
Yes.
We're a bit screwed, but, you know, here's some posters.
So it's a great, when you realize that was the moment in which they would have broken them out,
That's just so funny.
And so,
now, obviously, they're like one of the most shareable pieces of information.
But it's worth thinking about, you know, yes, we have challenging times. I mean, the United States, when the Vietnam era happened and you'd had JFK and MLK be shot both in the same year. I mean, we humans always have challenging times, but what I celebrate is we do rise to the occasion once it becomes clear that we've got to do something differently. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I continue to serve, is to one, share that it is doable, that these techniques of empowering the edge, of diversity, of working horizontally can help move things happen. And then finally, the last person I would contribute would be Dr. Ben Kaczynski at the Emory Business School. Ben was my dissertation advisor, and I literally applied to 15 different places when I was thinking about a PhD. Partly because it was interesting. Some schools said, well, we care about technology, but not people. Other places said, we care about people, but not technology. Ben cares about both. And he said, do you plan to go back to government service? And I said, for a while. I mean, I may see myself in the private sector later. He's like, well, don't say that too loudly. You know, he said, when you come into academia, there is sort of a rule that expected that the only thing you're ever supposed to do is academia. But I completely understand where your perspective is. And he supported looking at how to improve organizational response to turbulent environments. And then when I said, okay, I'm now going to go back to public service and go to Afghanistan, he was also supportive, which to me was a real credit to a dissertation advisor and someone that was himself a PhD and a professor.
That's amazing. And then how about the books as well?
Books. Where to begin?
Do you read a lot?
I do. I used to read a lot of more nonfiction. Now I do a lot of fiction lately, but I do fiction as analogs for some of the things our world is facing. I'm a big believer that if you find the right sci-fi, it's actually a analog for the philosophy of the things we're facing right now. So I'll toss out two, both are fiction right now. One is a book called Distraction. It was written by Bruce Sterling, I think in the late 90s, I want to say 1997, but may or may not be exactly right. And it was politics in D.C. in the year 2044. And it was how the impact of the internet was going to impact the electoral process and everything. And you read and you're like, seems like it's about 30 years ahead of schedule. But I share that because it was a good examination of how do you know what's truth? How do you know what's disinformation? It also had this idea that I really think is great called CREWES, with a K, K-R-E-W-E-S. And in it, Bruce Sterling is recommending that the future is really not one person doing a task, but groups of people doing a task together and getting rewarded for it. And if you imagine, he actually has this wonderful example of, what if you were trying to build a house and you had tagged each part of the house with a radio frequency identifier? And you could literally have the computer say, you know what, I'll solicit 10,000 volunteers. And all you have to do is, if you sign up as a volunteer, you show up at this specific time and insert slot B into slot C or slot J into slot K, and then you walk away. And literally, the task of each people doing like 2 minutes worth of work builds a house. And I'm like, that would be an interesting analog for the future, that we could sort of crowdsource things that by themselves are small tasks,
yeah,
but they end up being something big.
It's like the capture idea,
yes,
with Duolingo in the beginning, and how that was supposed to be, supposed to work out. It's very,
Or if you think about it, the other thing is, the more recent event, if you've seen Google Quick Draw, highly recommend it. So for your listeners, if you Google Quick Draw, it's basically where you get 20 seconds for six assignments to draw like a cat or a dog. And so you use your mouse or use your tablet or use your finger, and the machine is trying to guess what you're drawing. And it's getting really good.
And so that helps the machine.
Oh, yeah, you just taught the machine.
Yeah.
That what is like fun to us, and it's like almost playing like, win, lose, or draw or Pictionary, you've effectively taught the machine. And there were some times where I went to go, I practiced when it first came out, and it took a long time to guess. There are now times like when I do it, and it guesses in less than 4 or 5 seconds what I'm drawing.
Yeah.
And so we're teaching the machine.
I was listening to a podcast recently, and they were talking about, and I can't remember what the menial task was that helped, but I think it was identifying the genome elements. But
you're absolutely right. So there was folding at home, which was the idea of using the available computational cycles you had on your computer.
And that's right. It's a screensaver.
It's a screensaver. And it actually, I think it found upwards of more than 5 or 6 novel medical therapies that are now actually in use by people making time available. And you think about it, your smartphone now, according to some people, has more computing power than President Reagan had in 1981 through the Pentagon. And that the next 1 billion people on the face of the planet that don't have a smartphone that are going to get it are going to get it for less than $45. So that raises interesting questions about what are we going to do? Because in some respects, we're super empowering people to do things that were only available to the president 40 years ago. But what happens in a world in which everyone is super empowered? Is it good? Is it bad? Again, it gets back to how we choose how to do it. So that then gets to my second book recommendation, which is by a Scottish author, unfortunately, who passed away recently, but Ian M. Banks. Big fan of The Player of Games, but also its entire culture series, which is the culture series, for those who aren't familiar with it, is this idea of a fairly freewheeling, almost no rules, anarchistic society. And you might say that just sounds like a nightmare, but he actually portrays it as freeing of humans. And at the same time, the way you address, humans are still humans and they sometimes do bad things. The way you address it is we have almost like our internet of things that we are wearing. We also maybe have our own personal drone that if you try to do something to me that I've not given permission or agreement to do, my own wearables and my own drone politely slaps you back. It doesn't do anything too violent, but it just politely slaps you back. And so it's almost like the golden rule of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, except it's do unto others as they will permit you to do unto them. And I think that may be the type of philosophical conversation, because reality is
like a personal bouncer.
Yeah, your own personal bouncer. And if you want to have, if you and I want to engage in sword fight, we can. Or if you don't want to allow that, or if you want to have certain substances in the air be exposed to you, you can, or you can choose not to. Because you think about where the world is going, it's going to be increasingly difficult to provide stability in a top-down fashion. So mm-hmm. you do have to empower the edge, but the question is, the edge has different preferences. And to me, this again gets to the huge education component as well as public service component, that Western democracies, representative democracies, and republics were designed to be equitable in their treatment, but not personal in their treatment. Because the last thing you want is someone to get personal treatment from the government, and that's seen as wrong. But yet, increasingly, people are expecting on the consumer side that it is personalized to you, that it is tailored to your wants. I mean, that's what we expect from our smartphone. And so there's this expectation of personalization on the consumer front, but somehow we've got these checks and balances, which I understand why we have them. You don't want to have corruption, that prevent personalization from what your public service is providing you at the governmental level. Mm-hmm. And this is an unanswered question for how do we do representative democracies? How do we do the business of republics going forward? And I think we need to put that forward.
Because personalized learning is a huge trend as well in terms of, you know, continuing to put learners in that sort of optimum point of learning. So I've read different academic takes on it, and obviously there is some sort of pushback as well, and the whole role of the teacher in that and how far you can scale that. But what's your point on or your thoughts on personalized learning?
So I would say I'm a big fan of experiments and empirical-based evidence. And mm-hmm. so I support anyone who runs experiments and begins to show that this works or this doesn't, because that's how we avoid guruism and we begin to build a cumulative base. So maybe some more experiments are needed. I will say, from a technology perspective, I think it was, I want to make sure I get the date right. I want to say it was 2013. There was a competition to see if anyone could write a machine learning AI that would grade papers as good as a third grade teacher, find the same sentence mistakes and things like that. And for $60,000, apparently on Kraggle, someone won that competition. Now, that doesn't mean that teachers are out of business, but the machine could help some. Now, since then, there's been research that shows that for higher grade levels, the AI is not savvy enough right now to distinguish nuance and things like that. So the debate is still out. But my question is, what can we do to free the educator to allow the machine to do the rote work and to do the personalized or the more creative work to inspire the student, to make mm-hmm. sense of time? And then also recognize that students are now connected to the internet, if they're in at least developed nations, and increasingly in developing nations too, 24/7. So how can you make it so that learning is not just in the physical classroom, mm-hmm. but it's also when they go out? I mean, I found from my own personal experience, the time I enjoyed school the most is when I was working and doing school at the same time. When it was just school, I don't know, something about where you could like put in an application and work and then go back to school and do the theory and then sort of do that circle back and forth was more fun to me.
Yeah, doing a more modular basis rather than having like a 3-year degree, which by the end of it, you know, perhaps technology's moved on and then the first year is kind of irrelevant to applying it. So yeah, I think that will definitely happen. And then finally, so how can people follow you or find out more if they are listening to this? And I'm sure they will want to connect again.
Sure. So on social media, on Twitter, I am at FCC, that's Foxtrot Charlie _CIO.
You got your Twitter account.
Yes, I did. And so I'm happy to engage on there, and people can both ask questions and I'll respond. I do. It is me responding. It's not a bot. And then also on LinkedIn, I am, if you look up linkedin.com/in/Debray, Delta Bravo RAY. Happy to connect on LinkedIn as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this week's interview, everyone. Next week, we will be back with our second South by Southwest EDU 2017 EdTech Trends episode, this time looking at higher education, training and MOOCs. In other news this week, a big shout out to this week's sponsors, Glisser EDU. This is an easy one for me as I regularly use Glisser at events. Glisser is an audience engagement platform and they also have an education offer for socializing lectures where they take regular PowerPoint or keynote presentations and push each slide out live to students' mobile devices as they are presented. Professors, administrators and students get valuable data on where information is really engaging or needs reworking, and staff and students can interact through the deck. You can check them out at glisser.com/student-engagement. In the meantime, check out all the listener and first year celebrations and have a great week.